Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, this is March 6, 2017. Patrick, we're going to start out with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 532, and Patrick, you're up.
Thanks, you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 532 expands the prohibition of driving in the leftmost lane of travel to all vehicles. It provides exceptions, classifies the offense as a Class D traffic violation punishable by a maximum fine of $250. The measure also clarifies that campers, vehicles with trailers, and vehicles with registration weight of 10,000 pounds or greater must drive in the rightmost lane on roads with at least two lanes in a single direction of travel. We also have, Mr. Chair, before us the Dash 1 Amendment. The Dash 1 Amendment clarifies language regarding the exemption due to slower flow of traffic. We do not have paperwork on the Dash 1 Amendment at this time, Mr. Chair, so the measure is going to remain in committee today. We can't take action on it today.
Okay. Senators, please. It's always nice to hear the perennial move the heck over bill.
Move it on over there. I think this is something here shortly.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My goal this session is, my name is Jenny Burdick, for the record. I represent the people of Senate District 18. And my goal this session is to remove this from the perennial bill of the session status and to get it done. We've made several attempts in the past, as you know. Basically, Senate Bill 532 with the Dash 1 Amendment affirms that the left lane in a multi-lane highway is for passing, where the posted speed limit is greater or equal to 55 miles an hour. And after the last couple of sessions, we've made improvements into the in the bill to address some of the concerns, to make sure that people understand. And again, I was never worried about state police over enforcing a bill, for example, when the traffic was creeping along at 20 miles an hour.
I thought your concern was that they wouldn't get over.
My concern is definitely that they won't get over. In normal circumstances, in the category of you shouldn't have to legislate good manners, but in this case, there are cases out there where someone has plenty of room to move over into the travel lane, and for whatever reason, whether they're on their cell phone or just oblivious or just plain rude, they don't do it. So this gives the state police clear authority to ticket those drivers. And again, I trust the state police's discretion when conditions are bad. Like if there is ice in the travel lane and not in the passing lane, of course you wouldn't expect people to travel on the ice. But just in case, we covered that in the bill. So this would make our highway system safer and more efficient. It would cut down on road rage, and hopefully it would make people pay attention to what lane they're in rather than engaging in their favorite cell phone activity. So I have with me here, in addition to my esteemed colleague, Senator Farioli, we have Captain Fugate from the State Police, who's worked with us very closely to develop this bill. So, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. In a somewhat unusual permutation of the Stockholm syndrome, where the captor, where the captive over-identifies with their tormentor, I'm actually a co-sponsor on this bill with Senator Burdick. But I too share a couple of the concerns that the bill attempts to address, although I have less of an emphasis in than Senator Burdick, perhaps, on the use of devices, because that's not really what the bill deals with. I guess I was raised in an era where we were taught, I think I was taught, as most folks were, the left lane is the passing lane. The left lane is not the I will teach these people behind me to go the speed limit lane. It is not the let me get even with that guy that cut me off lane. It isn't the I'll engender some road rage lane. Maybe this is old school. I was told you use that lane to get around the car ahead of you, then you get out of that lane. And I think it's amazing that we do see, if you model the right behavior on the freeway, if you pass and then get back to the right lane, people behind you kind of tend to do, at least for the next minute or two, it seems like people actually follow the rules of the road. I do agree completely with Senator Burdick. It's not only a matter of safety, but it is a matter of courtesy. Oregonians have a lead foot. That's not rocket science. It just go on the freeway and you'll find out. But that left-hand lane should be a safety valve. You know, there are some folks that want to drive faster than others. If they want to take their chances with Captain Fugate and others in a blue uniform, it's not my job to become a traffic impediment. Let them do that, and they will take their chances and pay the consequences if they're cited. But in the meantime, that left driving lane should be clearly identified as a passing lane. And I think that would actually reduce the incidence of road rage and maybe make throughput easier. I hope it will improve the flow of traffic, certainly reduce the potential for road rage. At least 11 other states have such a specification in their statutes. I think that it's probably time for Oregon to help educate our neighbors from Washington State. They can't just pick a lane and park in it. They actually have to pass and then free the lane. We actually have stuff on the books about impeding traffic. Washington, I think, has statutes that are much more specific than ours. They actually specify if you impede, I think it's six automobiles or six vehicles, you got to pull over. It's probably time that we just really help to educate Oregonians and folks that drive on our highways that left lane has a utilitarian use. It's for passing. And so I'm supporting Senate Bill 532. And the other objective I have up here is to make sure that neither Senator Burdick or I embarrass Captain Fugate, because he's been kind enough to come and answer technical questions about the bill.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Bill Fugate, and I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police. I'm here today to voice my agency support for this bill. I have been a police officer for over 20 years, six of those years I work in city PDs, 14 years as a state trooper. I drive personally and for work about 40,000 miles a year, so I see a lot of different driving behavior. Like most of you, I spend many hours a week driving on multiple lane highways, state highways. Unfortunately, the highway is not being used efficiently by the travelers here in Oregon. There are many of those drivers who drive in the left lane and do not allow other drivers to pass even when there's an opportunity to do so, just like the senator mentioned. As I drive my personal vehicle on I-5, these drivers refuse to move over to the right, even when there's space to do so. My decision is to be respectful and follow for miles, hoping they'll recognize their ways and move over to share the road. Others tailgate these drivers with the hope that discomfort encourages them to move over. This is unsafe. Others are more aggressive, making bad lane changes, driving over the speed limit to maneuver around that left lane driver. That too is unsafe, and it can also lead to road rage and other issues. Some may believe the left lane drivers engaged in this behavior are not paying attention and that this law may be pointless. Last week, I made two trips to Portland from Salem to Portland back in my police vehicle. It's an E-plated state police vehicle. It's pretty obvious what it is. While I'm driving up I-5, every time I come up behind those left lane campers, as you will, they're pretty courteous when you're in a police car. They get over almost immediately. So, and I will offer also, if anybody wants to go on a ride along to go to Portland, I'll take you with me if you like. But they
hard to miss those lights.
So it's not. It's definitely a behavior, and I always compare it to, if you're in the grocery store walking down the aisle, you're not going to walk, right up the middle of the aisle, not share the aisle with the other people. It's just a courtesy issue, which the biggest thing, that reason we support this, is the secondary driving behavior that occurs following that. Time and time again, we all see it, people making bad passes on the right, passing on the left, tailgating, which can lead to other issues. At the Oregon State Police, we focus enforcement efforts on the five driving behaviors that lead to serious injury and fatal crashes. We use an acronym, which we call SOLID: speed, occupant safety, lane usage, impaired driving, and distracted driving. According to ODOT, traffic fatalities are trending higher than they have in the years past. Last year, 495 people were killed on Oregon's highways. It is my belief that this bill, if passed, would prevent some of those frustrated drivers from making poor driving decisions or engaging in road rage. To note, I'm not trying to assert myself as an expert in highway engineering or traffic efficiencies. And to be fair, I would also like to, that it's possible if this bill was passed, the left lane may not be used in fear of enforcement action decreasing the effectiveness of the highway. But to assure you, just like when the move-over law, moving over for the emergency vehicles in the shoulder, it was an education effort. And we spent a lot of time educating the public and not citing just a lot of information out there, focused traffic enforcement and just getting the public to be aware of this driving behavior. In closing, I would like to mention if we could prevent even one fatality from occurring by the passage of this bill, it'll be a success. Thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Captain. Any questions? Sure. Senator Riley?
Yeah, I'm just curious about when I'm preparing to pass on the left as I move from the traveling lane to the passing lane, how far back can I be from that car that I'm going to pass?
So, Senator Beyer, Senator Riley, so you're asking, let's say we're in the left lane or passing lane, as Senator Farragulli references, you're following distance prior to them moving out of the way?
No.
Okay.
If we're both in the traveling lane, we're moving slower than the speed limit, mm-hmm. and I want to pass a car ahead of me, how far back from that car may I assume that I can move over to the passing lane? Is it 100 yards? Is it a half a mile?
So to make that lane change safely. So Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, so well, you know, it's just there is statute and laws out there. So when you do make that pass, it's making a safe pass. You're not cutting the other driver off. Mm-hmm. There may be times, you know, hypothetically, that traffic is just too congested, and that driver can't safely move into traffic. And during that circumstance, that'd be the education part, the enforcement part, and kind of the spirit of what this law is intending.
No. Yeah, I don't think you understood my question yet.
I'm not sure first, so I'm trying to be technical.
Please.
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, in Senator Burdick's case, it's 11 feet. You should maintain the safe driving distance that you'd normally drive. In other words, in multiple of car lengths, depending on your speed.
That's still not the question.
No, it's still not the question. you're telling me how far back I should be.
Yeah.
I'm asking how far back may I be before I make that move into the left lane.
So
if there's
like
a car
miles.
Quarter mile ahead of me.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, thanks for the clarification. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it's not impeding traffic, you know, obviously there'd be a good discretion by the officer, deputy, or trooper. And I get that. You know, some people want to have more distance when they move out and around, so it's a more intentional and obvious act. Because that's what we always tell our kids to teach them to drive. Drive, be predictable. So that's a great question. But yeah, obviously, if somebody moves way over and just takes their time or 3 miles to make that pass, that could be an issue and an education portion for law enforcement.
Thank you.
Senator Monroe, I
think as long as
yeah,
you're
I mm-hmm. traditionally, I've been involved in a lot of traffic safety stuff over the years. And traditionally, when I'm driving down here from Salem, I drive in the middle lane because the right lane is usually a lot of trucks. I drive in the middle lane. And then I pass when I need to and I get back over into the middle lane. Right now, that doesn't work very well because the middle lane's all chewed up from the winter. It's the biggest pothole. It's one pothole after another. And so the last couple times I've come down, I've driven in the passing lane, and somebody comes up behind me, I move over, then I move back into the, because it's smooth, and the middle lane is chopped up all to pieces. In enforcing this law, would you take things like that into consideration?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, absolutely. It is in the bill for law. It's an exception to the statute. Road conditions, that example you mentioned, there could be debris in the road or just other circumstances, you know, including even an emergency vehicle on the shoulder of the road causing all traffic to move left. So that would be covered in this.
Thank you.
Senator, I would note, I think that's what included in the dash one.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Any others? Thank you. And we'll let Representative Helm speak.
Thank you so much.
The other chief co-sponsor of this bill.
I'm a good Metro lawyer.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you for having me. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34 in Beaverton. Senator Burdick and I teamed up on this same issue in 2015, and I had the unhappy experience of not being able to convince all of my colleagues, or a majority of my colleagues, to vote for the bill. And so we're back again because it is a good idea. And
you're not telling me that the House killed a Senate bill. We know that never happens.
It was worse. It's worse, Mr. Chair. We passed a bill out. It came to the Senate. It was amended to make it a little better. And then when it came back for concurrence, some of our folks that are retired on law enforcement members couldn't figure out how it would work. And in part, now I'm not going to speak for them, but in part they had similar questions to Senator Riley. You know, are we going to have a gotcha situation out there for folks that are trying to abide by the law, but they are just either stuck in the middle lane waiting to get into the left lane and pass, or they get into the left lane and there are so many vehicles that are going slow in the middle lane that they get caught up in this massive slow down over there, and they could get pulled over for that. I think that the -1 amendment helps that. It helps clarify that you should be in the far left-hand lane only for passing, and it improves the existing law quite a bit. The only thing that I would want to add beyond what our senators and my co-chief sponsors have said is to tell you, they've been doing this in Washington for several years now. They've had this on the books, I think, for 4 or 5 years. And they've been pulling over a lot of folks for hogging the left lane. And I think a lot of those are warnings. But we have at least one number for you. It's a 2015 number that was released here in March, about a year ago, as the Washington State Patrol got ready to do an emphasis on left lane driving. And during that time, in preparation for that push, they released a statistic that in 2015, Washington State Patrol stopped 13,909 vehicles. So they're using this law in Washington, and it's working. And it's not having some of the gotcha effects that we're afraid of down here. It's not creating traffic safety problems in the enforcement. And apparently the law is resilient enough that it can withstand challenges. So our law, as this bill amends it, will become much similar to Washington State's law that the State Patrol is operating under up there. So I think we can have some confidence by looking to our friends to the north who have been doing this a while and seeing that under essentially the same road conditions, especially on I-5, we could expect some of the same results.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Senator Riley?
So when you're talking about a gotcha law, I don't believe that our state patrolmen are going to do that any more than they already do. As an example, I did a ride along with an officer whose name I won't use, and he said, "There's something wrong with that car. I don't know what it is." And we followed it for a long way until they made a lane change without a signal. So you can stop any car on the road anytime you want to if you follow them long enough. This will be one more way to do that. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but it is one more way to do that.
Anybody else? Thank you, Representative. Let's get back to work.
Thank you.
Not that you weren't working, but...
I've got a committee I'm supposed to be running next week.
I'm familiar with that problem. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and yes, this is a perennial move-over bill, and we certainly support it as we have in the past, and one of the reasons that I did want to testify is that trucks have been required to move over for many, many years, and this just brings cars in the same level as trucks. But I have noticed myself in driving around the state that there is a lot of unsafe activity that's caused by people hanging out in the left lane. There's a lot of folks that are weaving in and out. And you may recall in the old days we used to have signs on the back of our trucks. And on the left side it said passing side. On the right side it said suicide. And what we see a lot is there's people passing trucks on the right hand side, which is in their blind spot, and they can't see them. So if it will decrease the activity of the weaving in and out and passing trucks on the right hand side by clearing that left hand lane, then we're in total support.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Questions? I see none. Thank you. That's all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 532. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We'll open a work session, and then I think we'll adopt the amendment. Okay. That's all that we do.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 532.
Senator Thompson has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 532. Is any discussion? Is there any opposition? The amendment is adopted, and we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a...
Can we recess for just a second, wait for Senator Gelser? She's just right next
door. She's right next door? So you want to take a recess?
She wants to testify on this on 470.
So all right, we're going to take a five-minute recess. Let her know. But on Senate Bill 470, Patrick, 470.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 470 prohibits provisions of instruments conveying real property that restrict the use of the property as a certified family child care home. It prohibits enforcement of condominium or homeowner association prohibitions or restrictions on the use of units in a certified family child care home. And it also applies to instruments executed and provisions adopted on or after the measure's effective date. We have no amendments, and we do not have fiscal revenue impact statements as of yet, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm a state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, and the surrounding areas. This bill actually comes to you from Senator Boquist, but I have had the opportunity to talk with a constituent in my area. Senator Boquist and I abut one another in our legislative districts and was really moved by their story. You will hear from Tracy in just a few minutes. He and his wife opened a childcare, a wonderful childcare program in their home that was doing all of the things that we say that we want in terms of expanding access to quality, affordable childcare that is inclusive of all children, including children with disabilities. And then his homeowners association said that he couldn't do that anymore. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, and this bill would remedy that situation. I know we've had a number of homeowners association bills in the past. I am a person that is of the belief that sometimes HOAs can get a little bit overzealous in the regulation of how people are using their property and their homes, and this is one of those cases. It's a simple fix, and I commend the bill to you and hope that you'll listen to the story and help move this forward. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Is there any questions to the senator? Senator Monroe.
Sarah, this is interesting. There's a shortage of good child care in this state. A lot of people have to choose between child care and their job. People are providing quality child care in their home. We need to protect that, so I applaud your efforts.
That's true, Chair Beyer. Senator Monroe, thank you for that. It is extremely challenging to find child care at all, to find quality child care where you feel good about the people that are caring for your children. It is especially true for families that are raising children with disabilities. So the idea that a quirk in a homeowners association regulation would deny children with disabilities access to a quality, affordable child care placement, to me, seems like it's worthy of a statutory change.
Any others? Thank you, Senator. We'll let you get back to your committee.
Chair.
And we'll move on. Tracy Lang. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Tracy Lang, and I'm the constituent for this bill, and I live in
Sonoma,
Oregon.
Please have a seat. Make yourself comfortable.
Thanks for listening to me today, Chairman Beyer and the members of the committee. This bill is only to provide permission to operate a certified family child care home within an HOA-regulated community. It doesn't take any of the other look and feel or any of the other regulatory things away from the committee, it just from the association. It just says you must allow it to happen and then allow the rest of the negotiations to occur. Today, as you're already aware, we are operating at about 68% of the capacity for child care in the state of Oregon. The recent Oregon Department study commissioned by the state of Oregon early child care into OSU has said this is only going to get worse, that more and more homes are moving into managed areas. There's actually a preference in young home buyers to buy in condominiums today. Certified child care homes are the most regulated home by the state of Oregon. They're regulated by footprint. Sometimes those homes are actually healthier and cleaner than their neighboring homes. Also, child care homes provide about 25% of the overall child care. So they, as an entity, provide a lot of jobs. They provide a lot of care for others. Our personal story, as was mentioned earlier, we've had a child care home for about 4 years. We've been involved in foster care. This is not new territory for us. And the issue that we had is that after we'd been operating the care for 4 years, which everyone in the community had known about, that the clause no businesses are allowed was exercised. And in fact, I appreciate the desire and the need to have HOAs and the regulation that they can provide, that sometimes when some of those governing entities are a little bit misinformed and they aren't potentially looking at the big picture, our own census data, our own state data says the gap is going to increase for child care. And if we don't get in front of it, then we will be in trouble. I'd mentioned that I don't know how folks feel about California. Maybe we like Washington better than California. California introduced and adopted language like this over 10 years ago. And they've been working through those different things. They've worked through areas where perhaps there is a different kind of a damage deposit that would be for someone, or ways to preserve the look and feel of the neighborhood. But what the bill does, it just says you may not say no. You must include and you must reach out to others and help with the situation. So we do have a crisis in Oregon, and we do want to help try to solve it.
Questions? I guess not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Coxley.
Chair Beyer, committee members. My name is Greg Coxey. I'm a partner with the law firm of Isle Fotheringham. I'm actually here on behalf of the Community Association Institute Legislative Action Committee, which is in here in Oregon, dealing with legislation for homeowners associations, as well as the Oregon Washington Community Association of Managers and the Ad Hoc HOA Condo Working Group. Between these organizations, we have representation of thousands of homeowners associations in the state of Oregon. There are some concerns about this bill, for one, being overly broad. If the legislature is going to go this far to make it so that associations can't prohibit this, there needs to be at least the opportunity to have some rules in place. Some of the concerns that these groups have is once you, you know, most governing documents do prohibit a business type entity. However, the individual associations can amend their governing documents and provide for that sort of thing, and it's up to each one of those associations to do so. In addition, you know, part of the reason that we have homeowners associations is to try to increase property values to benefit the community as a whole. And if we allow businesses into associations, you know, if we allow this one, then what's the next business that individuals want to have in their homeowners association? Is it a doggy daycare? Is it a bike mechanic shop? I mean, where does that end? In addition, the certified family child care homes can have up to 16 children. Now, having 16 children run around in the in a homeowners association, let's say if they are wanting to use a community pool or even out in the streets, there's liability concerns on behalf of associations that carry those liability insurance policies. And you know, what we have is essentially one individual's experience, bad experience with the homeowners association. And we know that in homeowners associations, you're not going to make everybody happy all the time. And so, you know, for that reason, we are speaking against this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Riley.
So, laws basically are created because of bad experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And the, if everybody, you know, if everyone followed the law, we wouldn't need stop signs. I mean, if everyone did the right thing, we wouldn't need stop signs. And you say this is one homeowner association, and maybe they did what they thought was right, and but we you know, talking about 16 kids running around a homeowner association, that doesn't make it, you know, that's not going to happen. If we have a certified child care home, they're not going to allow those 16 kids to be running around over the homeowner association. So I just wanted to get that on the record that one homeowner association not allowing it is why we have to do this.
May I make a comment to that?
Go ahead, please.
Well, with all due respect, I think that, you know, if this was an issue of greater public concern where you have multiple homeowners associations, I mean, homeowners associations, there's thousands of them in the state of Oregon, you know, with hundreds of thousands of people in associations. And if this is an issue that you know, is that important of an issue, I think that we would see more people down here testifying on behalf of that bill.
Just a second. Senator Monroe, then Senator Girard.
Yeah, my wife was in the child care business for 20 years, and there are pretty strict rules as to how many children one caretaker can take care of. And it's not 16, it's like two or three, depending on the age. Depends on the age, how many they can take care of. And so I'd like to have additional information, if possible, as to what the rules actually are on this.
Okay. Senator Girard?
Well, the obvious question to me is that this is contractual law, and the individual who bought the home, correct me if I'm wrong, knew the CC&Rs when they bought the real estate. So what you're asking for is just to maintain the contractual law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and most of it comes with they don't want commercial businesses within the homeowners association. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
What?
No, this is a real tough one, I got to tell you, because, I mean, I understand what Senator Monroe is saying, and we need child care, On the other hand, contractual law, they sort of knew that. So for me, is kind of a tough one because the other people may have bought the property just because of the CCRs, GCNRs. So I don't know.
Well, and if I may make a comment to that, you're right. If it's an issue in the association that enough people are concerned about, you have that opportunity to amend your
right.
governing documents to provide for it. Mm-hmm.
Sir, I guess the question I want to ask is, there are already existing in Section 1 of the bill restrictions. This is restricted. You can't restrict the use of the property that is licensed, you know, under, you know, Section 443 of the ORS to provide residential care alone or in conjunction with treatment or training or a combination thereof. That already exists, and I'm trying to contrast that with, is it that much different by adding a certified child care center home? That has the features of a business, which you're objecting to, I understand. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that already exists in law.
It does. In all honesty, I wasn't practicing when that was put into place, and so I don't know what the back and forth was on that. But you know, on a go forward basis, the more that we chip away at the association's own CCNRs, I think we're starting to run afoul of what homeowners associations try to do.
Okay, I hear you. Anything else? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we do not have all the paperwork to act on this bill today, so we're going to close the public hearing and set it over to another day. And we will move to our final bill, which is a public hearing on Senate Bill 474. We'll open that. That was good enough, done enough to skip right off your...
Most impressive. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 474 eliminates the continuing education requirements for landscape construction professionals. This measure comes to us. We have currently no amendments in hand, and there is no fiscal statement or revenue statement yet available for this measure either, Mr. Chair.
All right. So, I got a bunch of people. All right, let's start out with, I'm going to try and call you up three at a time. So Wes Butler, David Sedlak, I may have said that wrong, I apologize, and Mike Schrock. Apologize if I murdered your name.
Way back.
I think we've seen this subject before. Haven't we, Senator Thompson?
I know these guys. We spent a lot of time together.
Please.
The Chair, Buyer, and Committee, I'm Wes Butler. Been a landscape contractor and involved in the landscape industry for many years, about 11 years in California and the balance here in Oregon. Regulations have always been somewhat of an irritation when it inhibits business and really doesn't... resolve any problems. So I'm just going to read what I have here, and I guess we'll go from there. So we are in favor of SB 474. I'm optimistic that you'll be able to help us improve the law by passing this as a positive change. I believe that continuing education came into being, I could be corrected on this, about 12 years ago. So we didn't have continuing education for landscape professionals prior to that. SB 474 eliminates continuing education requirements mandated by the state for the construction industry. Continuing education has happened before and after this law was put into effect. So what I'm saying by that is that we have had continuing education regardless of the law. It's a good idea to do continuing education in any facet of life, but I believe that this should happen happen privately without the mandatory nature of being law. Private trade organizations could record this information for consumers to check on if it's desired to even know. We have participated in a Senate work committee on this general subject with Senator Thompson, initiated by Chair Beyer, which we appreciated. We have presented deregulation ideas to the LCB in work sessions and meetings with really no result. That's just a fact. Continuing education continues to be a good thing for private organizations to foster and the public to seek out if interested. Continuing education is a natural response to being in business. It happens along the way. And I don't think government needs to regulate it. Private trade organizations and suppliers around the state provide lots of opportunity for continuing education, besides what you can do on your own, on-the-job training, seeking counsel from other people that have been in the industry. I have never seen a measured benefit to state-mandated continuing education in the landscape industry. I don't think I'm blind, but I haven't. It's another layer of regulations that costs consumers money, slows the process of conducting business, and costs contractors time and money. And frankly, I can't tell you how many I've talked to. A lot of them worry about it. They worry about complying with the law, and instead of maybe doing some other things they should be doing in their business. Mandated continuing education has always appeared to me to be something that might help the consumer to let down their guard, along with some of the other state requirements, and have them believe that they are protected by the state. I don't think they should assume that they are protected by continuing education, mainly because the essence of business is good and bad character, not necessarily training. The real key to consumer protection is going to be in the good or bad character of a particular entity. So the bottom line with that is that we have a court system that resolves issues between two parties, and I don't believe that any of the layers of regulation, and in this case mainly continuing education, I don't believe it protects the consumer in any way, shape, or form. And I hope you'll help us move forward with Senate Bill 474. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Hi, my name is David Sedlicek, landscape architect and contractor with Aspen Landscape, Senator Chair and Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share my views on this matter. I've been in the trade for the industry for like 35 years, something like that, and about 20 plus years here in Oregon. And, you know, I'm very serious about my profession, as are my peers. And one thing about the landscape construction industry is it is extremely diverse. When a law is passed to require something, a regulation, that regulation should be there because there's a need for it. There's a potential harm if something isn't done, if some requirement is not made. The thing about the landscape industry is that, as I said, it's extremely diverse. There are landscapers that plant flowers. There's landscapers that, you know, engineer some amazing structures, and it includes some, you know, concrete, masonry, electrical. It's phenomenally diverse. If there was something that was like, this is a health, safety, and welfare issue, public concern, these people must be knowledgeable about this. There's no way that continuing education, since it isn't specifically requiring some specific thing that you must learn, there's no way it's going to make sure that that's addressed. And, you know, landscaping, on the one hand, it's extremely diverse. On the other hand, generally speaking, it's not brain surgery. We aren't usually dealing with things that are of extreme threats to the public. And as Wes inferred in what he was testifying to, we are driven by our passion to do beautiful and exciting things and to be successful and provide for our families. Pretty much the least efficient time I spend educating myself is when I'm complying with the continuing education requirements. We're educating ourselves all the time. When I'm not, you know, caring for my family and running the day-to-day affairs of my business, I am reading, and in this day and age, it's so easy. There's so many opportunities to read and to learn about so many things, and I just love learning about plants. And again, because it's so diverse, I'm going to focus in on the areas that I have an interest in, and some other peer, they may not know anything about what I know about. They may be, you might think they're, oh no, they're a hazard to, you know, to the public, health, safety, and welfare. But their business is focused in on a legitimate service that they provide for the public, that they should have a right, in my view, to provide to the public without having some grand requirement to meet all these diverse standards. And again, since we aren't required to meet all these diverse standards as far as our education goes, really all it is throwing a dart at a dartboard and saying, well, we just think it'd be good if you stay up on education and be professional. You know, we all agree with that. We all think that we should stay up and be professional. But in the areas of our expertise, and again, as Wes said, the private sector has ways to, you know, there's the association, and we're all for that. They can, you know, promote education, and they can say, they can argue the case for you should hire somebody who's a member of their association, who's passed these tests and all those things. And, you know, again, that's what drives all of us to be educated. I am driven to be educated because my competition might take my business away from me. Yeah. So I am very, you know, driven to do that. And I again, as Wes said, I can't see that the reason for the historic application of continuing education is having any return on investment other than taking up our time.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Senator Beyer and committee, my name is Mike Schrock. I'm with Living Water Landscape. I've been in business in the landscape industry for a little over 30 years. I grew up in the nursery industry and has been doing landscaping for a lot of years. And so I am probably one of the few landscapers that are here. I do work both in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. And as the representative said earlier, kind of pointing to the state of Washington, see how they do it up north. Up north, they have none of these requirements. And you know what? They're not having any problems either. And the point that I'm trying to make is that it's a regulation that's really just not necessary. We have way stricter rules here in the state of Oregon, and yet I'm licensed in both states, and I basically go around doing busy work to meet the requirements in the state of Oregon that I don't have to do in the state of Washington. And so I think that's an important thing for us to recognize, that it is busy work that we're doing. And I say that because right now, I mean, as a licensed landscape contractor, I have between 5 and 10 employees throughout the year. I'm a small company. I do a lot of work for seniors. These little regulations, it may not seem like it's a little deal, but it's every time I turn around, I have to spend add another $5 to their bill. And to seniors, that's a big deal. For me personally, our company, we have to have 9 different technical licenses to do what we do. 9. For 5 to 10 employees. We have to have 5 extra city licenses. There are so many regulations. So it's not like saying continuing education is such a big deal. We really need to do that. It's the straw to me that breaks the camel's back. And for me personally, I'm not looking at how I can expand my company. Honestly, I'm looking at how I can get out of the industry. I just want y'all to know it's kind of gotten to the point to where I'm ready to give up. I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of all the regulations. It seems like it's not just this regulation, but just last week we got pulled over and by a police officer because we didn't have a DOT sticker in our glove box. And then he said, you don't have that? No. Well, I didn't even know I was supposed to have that. Again, it's another regulation. When we found out about that, we opened up the door to a Pandora's box here where 100 other regulations now, because we have to get this DOT sticker. We've got to get testing and drug testing for drivers. And we're talking about a pickup truck and a trailer We're not talking about a big 18-wheeler. But my point is that it's one regulation after the other, after the other, after the other, and I'm just tired, and I'm ready to get out of it. And so I just wanted to voice that point of view. For me personally, I just got my license information this week. I looked back over the last 2 years, and I said, okay, what have I taken? Well, I took a class that I would have taken whether the law was in place or not. I took a class on water features because I want to know about it. And then I took a class 2 years ago or within the time period. I can't even remember what the class was about. I can't remember one thing. I was taking it because I have to. Don't even know why I took it. It's not that I'm against education at all. I think education is very important. If I have a choice, I want to send one of my men to get educated on something, but I don't have the money, extra money to send them because I'm forced by this law for me to do it because I'm the one that carries the license. I would much rather be able to say as a business owner, you know, our company needs this. Billy, you're going to go take this class. But I don't have the money to do that because I have to spend the money on me. I mean, some of these classes are free, but some of them are $450, and I don't have the money to do that. So for me, it's an overregulation that is not required. I'm going to do what it takes to be a good businessman. We have no complaints in our company from the Landscape Contractors Board. There's no complaints that people have ever complained about our company because we do what it takes to be a good businessman, and if we're not good in business, we're not going to be in business. And so it's not that regulation. And so to me, I would just say, I would encourage you all, let's take one of the regulations off the board for us and make it just that much easier for us to stay in business. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Tina, thanks, guys.
Thank you. All righty. Steve Cravino, Marilyn Alexander, and Lauren Radford. And if I mispronounce your name, I apologize.
That's all right.
I think I did.
Happens on a regular basis. Okay, is it weird how you sit there and you say, I'm all nice and calm, but your heart rate is going?
Don't worry about it. Just take it easy.
Okay, so here's the deal. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this.
I need you to put your name on record, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair and...
Oh, just say your name.
Steve Cravino, Cravino Landscape and Lighting.
Yeah.
I've been in business for 36 years because I enjoy doing it. One of the first things I do when I speak to a customer is I look them right in the eye and I say, I want to make sure that you feel comfortable with whoever you hire, whether it's me or someone else. So I tell my customer that it's important for them to do their homework. It's important for them to check out maybe our website, to look things over and realize that they have an option to select different contractors. And it's my goal to impress upon them that I'm knowledgeable and I can do the job properly for them. As far as the continuing education goes, the way it works, the experience that I've had with continuing education is I come in, I get my mail, I open it up, I take a look at it, and it says I need to have 8 credit hours because I've been in business over 5 years. But if I've been in business under 6 years, if I've been in business less than 6 years, I need 16 credit hours. So I'm thinking, logically, that maybe after 20 years, I won't need any. I mean, I don't understand the logic in that, to be honest with you. And that's the one thing I wanted to say. The other thing I wanted to say is that when you go do these classes, you can go online and spend $15, $20, whatever, and just do it real quick and just to get it done. So, okay, that's worth 3 credit hours. And then you look up another one and you do that one and you fill it out real quick, you know, like was already mentioned, and you get done and 3 or 4 years later, you don't even remember what you did. The point is that a person goes into business, they work hard to do the best they possibly can. When 08 rolled around, a lot of landscape contractors got weeded out. They couldn't make it. Well, why didn't they make it? Well, they weren't stable. They didn't put the time and effort into building a good quality company, in my opinion. There might be some exceptions to that, but I feel that the harder you work, the further you're going to get. And I think that forcing someone to educate themselves because it's a state requirement doesn't, you don't get out of the gate right. You're not starting out right. You're forced to take this education, and you don't even really care. All you're focused on is just getting the credit hours so you can continue to have your license. Anyway, let's see. Let me check my notes here real quick.
Did you get it all covered?
I think so. Let's see. I think I did.
Thank you very much. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for letting me speak today. Chairperson and committee members. My name is Marilyn Alexander, and I am a landscape designer. I've also been an instructor. I'm a retired instructor from PCC Landscape Technology for about 13 years. I own my own landscape business as well in design, and I'm the president of the Association of Professional Landscape Designers, the Oregon chapter for this year. And I also have my LCP, so I am a landscape construction professional licensee. As a designer, I want to work with qualified people, people that have education, that have knowledge, that have skills, and have been in business for a long time or a short time, and are continuing to build that education as they go along. And so I am against the bill as it's presented. As a designer and as being a member of Association for Professional Landscape Designers, I have to show that I am educated. I have to continue to educate myself with continuing education units for APLD. They also have a program for certification where I have to, if I was certified, I would have to submit my portfolio so that I could be peer reviewed. And the organization, this is a national, international organization for designers that is also, in the next 5 years, going to put out a national exam for designers so that they, again, can improve their worth. In the state of Oregon, we don't have a contractors. We don't have a board that licenses designers. But in the state of Oregon, you do have a contractors board that licenses contractors. And to become an LCP, you have to have the education. You have to have the experience just to sit for the exam. You have to take the exam. And now you have to do continuing education hours, which I think are very important to keep up with current practices in the field of contracting. So I support, I am against the bill because I support continuing education requirement by our board. And I am a licensee that's only been around for under 6 years, and so I have to put in 16 credit hours every 2 years to maintain my license. Why I think that's so important is because our climate is changing and we are essentially environmental stewards. We need to be able to design as well as install landscapes that are low impact on our environment and continue to improve our environment and not degrade it. So I think keeping up on our continuing education requirements for the license is important. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sir.
Hello, Chairman Beyer, members of the Business and Transportation Committee. My name is Lauren Radford, and I am here representing only myself. I do sit on the State Landscape Contractors Board, but I'm not representing them in any way, shape, or form today. I'm just representing myself, who's someone who's been in the green industry for about 41 years. I'm retired now, but I've been a landscape contractor, I've been a tree service contractor, I've been a vocational teacher of arboriculture and horticulture, and I've been an extension agent. I'm here in opposition to the bill today. I'm kind of perplexed at this bill. I thought this was all kind of hashed out 2 years ago with Senate Bill 580 when this was reduced to be more in line with the Construction Contractors Board, but I guess it hasn't. As some of my prior colleagues had mentioned, landscape is a very varied field. There's lots of stuff that we do that's very technical. And technology, the methodologies and the materials that are used are changing constantly. How I used to do a job in 1985 is not the same way I did it in 1995, nor in 2005, nor in 2015. And the idea that somehow you don't need to learn anything new, well, it's kind of a jaw-dropper for me. The responsible contractors, yes, they will, whether they're mandated to do that or not. But in reality, not all contractors are responsible. So some minimal level of competency training, I think, is essential. Some of my colleagues have complained that it's difficult to find CEH opportunities. And I would concur if you're not looking at for them in the first place. All you have to do is go to one website, the LCB website, and on it, as of yesterday, there were listed 117 online CEH opportunities. When you're talking about face-to-face type things, such as courses or a trade show, a trade association meeting, or a vendor, a seminar, there's all kinds of gobs of ways by which you can get CEHs. There are 420 some odd and change opportunities there. So unless you're a contractor in the bottom of the Waihee Canyon with no internet or cell phone coverage, I think there's an opportunity to get those. If this bill is passed, we would be the only construction trade, and we are a construction trade, that does not require of our members even the minimal amount of updating their skills. Senate Bill 580 put us in relative parity with the Construction Contractors Board. There, if you're a single category license holder, either residential or commercial, you're required to get 8 CEHs every 2 years if you've had a license 6 or more years. Now, if you have both residential and commercial category under the CCB, you're required to take 16. Landscapers that do residential or commercial work are only required to take 8, the same 8 that we have already. If you're a plumber or electrician, you're going to be required between 4 to 24 additional CEHs from the Building Codes Division, so you keep up to date with the codes by which you're operating. Landscape contractors that do decks or fences or backflow, which are all code items, are required 0 CEHs that they must take in those areas. So I would submit that the landscape industry are probably some of the most CEH under-encumbered of the construction trades in Oregon now. The LCB has always been very adamant in the past that, and telling us contractors, we are not here to protect you. We are here to protect the consumer. So I would posit the question of, how does eliminating any obligation for even minimal updating of skills and knowledge by which you're doing business in the public arena of any benefit to consumers? I just can't find a plausible argument for that. So I think this bill is bad for consumers. I think it's bad for the professionalism of the industry, and I believe good professionalism is also good business. It's therefore bad for business, and I would urge you to oppose it. Again, my name is Lauren Rapper, and I'm here only representing myself. Thanks for your time and ear.
Thank you very much. A question, Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned a couple of things that I have been thinking about, and one of them is decks. Landscapers do build decks. And one of the things that I hope they learn in their continuing education is about puncturing the moisture barrier. These are things that you need to know if you're going to build anything that attaches to a house. You need to know things like French drains so that you don't flood the house that you're building, that you're doing work next to. I'm opposed to this bill for those reasons. It is a consumer protection issue, and I sat for 6 years on the Consumer Protection Committee, and we looked at these issues every year, and continuing education is essential to making sure that the folks who don't want to take those courses actually do.
Thank you very much.
Okay, David West and John Stone. Welcome.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, fellow committee members.
You don't need to get that close to the mic. You can just sit back and be comfortable.
All right. My name is David West, Structures and Landscape. I started my first landscape company when I was 13 years old. Had my first employee when I was 15. Went through college. Started an engineering degree and finished out in landscape architecture. And I grew up working in the southeast part of the country, Tennessee, where there were no rules and regulations. I have seen it from both sides of the fence. And our last speaker did a really good job of laying down what's at stake here. A landscape business is one of the hardest businesses to be in. Only the restaurant business is more risky. And there are so many moving parts. I can build a pond that's 2 million gallons. I can build a retaining wall 10 feet tall. I built some very complicated decks. Our company is Structures and Landscape. We do some very unique and complicated things. I went to one of our seminars to learn about the envelope package, which means when you're skinning a house, how you would treat the rain drain screen behind. And I learned one detail that probably saved me a $100,000 litigation process by going to one class for 1 hour. And I thought, I'd already been in business 15 years, and here came a new product that I could recognize. And materials change so fast. From 1996 to 2001, you were allowed to have what they called an OSB ledger for your house. Anybody who drilled into that ledger board and did not backcock and backflash would have water leaking into the rim joist. And I have personally torn off 15 houses that are new construction. I'm talking 1996 to 2000, where I had to jack the house up and replace the substructure from a prior landscaper who did not understand about backcocking and the envelope flashing. Now they have classes on that. It's not very hard to go get those classes. And to anybody who says it's hard to get the CEUs, the credits, it's just not true. And more importantly, it's the camaraderie between going to those classes, what I call the grease in the system. When you're next to two people or three people or five or ten, and you're in a class, and you're telling war stories about what you saw and what you did, you gain more in that 1 hour from your comrades in that room than you do from actually signing the paper and getting the credit. Being pulled together. I guess what I really want to tell you is the landscape contracting business, people keep hush hush. There's competitors. You're trying to be quiet. You don't tell your secrets. Everybody keeps the things they learn to themselves. And these materials are changing and changing and changing. When Trex first came out with synthetic decking, the first two generations failed. And so if you are a brand new person laying those products down, you hadn't gone to seminar classes and recognized what the failure rates are and how to identify those. If you're an electrician and you do a job and you energize a system, you're going to know right then and there if you've had a ground fault or not. If you're a plumber and you energize the house for the first time, you're going to know if you have an issue or not. But when you're a landscaper, we call them sleepers. The tree planted too deep fails in 10 years later. The cost is huge to remove the tree. A French drain or a retaining wall not protected the right way slowly creeps into crawl space. Litigation can resume years down the road. So getting these continuous credits, yeah, you can be a landscaper. You can be just going out there doing fly-by-night and doing some things. But if you're truly in business and you really want to protect the consumer, and the landscape contractor has more potential to affect the consumer than just about anybody, because some things are so hard to recognize once they're buried. especially irrigation systems. The codes that we dwell in aren't really regulated. When you're building a brand new house package, you go through a real regiment of getting your codes approved. But in landscaping, there's so many ways to wiggle around the rules. And these credits that you would go for, continuing education credits, really help you stay on the board with your competition. If the competition is going, then we need to go. You know, it takes, what's to be gained by getting this bill passed? I save an afternoon worth of work. What's to be lost? A lifetime of regret? One detail I could learn in one class? Understanding a situation that I could have educated myself on better? It's easy to sit back and be lazy, but I think what we really need to do is do the right thing and oppose this bill and keep it the way it is. Thank you.
I'm getting to be a little worried about time, so that's it.
My name is John Stone. I own a company in the Portland area called J.P. Stone Contractors. I'm here representing the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. We stand opposed to this bill. A couple of years ago, we spent a lot of time with the help of Senator Thompson getting our bill adjusted, partly to some of the people who are involved in the current bill. We worked pretty hard with the senator. We got legislation affected that we're pretty happy with. We're sorry to be here in front of you taking up your important time at this time. We don't think that this is worth any more of your time than you've currently spent. The previous people have all spoken eloquently to the need for continuing education. For my money, even the ones who spoke against it actually spoken for it. We're just happy that you're hopefully predisposed to pass on this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions of these gentlemen?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the last two I have are Mark Landau and Ben Cunningham. Welcome, gentlemen. Please.
You were on first. Oh,
very good. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Special Districts Association and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. I'm here on behalf of municipal water suppliers. Municipal water suppliers supply approximately 75% of the water delivered to the citizens of Oregon. That's about 3.3 million people. Just to give you some context here, most of Oregon's surface water has been completely allocated. There's no more surface water to be handed out. We expect another million people to enter the state of Oregon and become residents of our great state in the next 50 years. So we only have a finite resource and we have a growing demand. How do we expect to deliver water to the new people who ultimately arrive? Most of that is going to be achieved through conservation and efficiency. During the summer months, water use spikes. It goes up approximately 50 to 60% than it does during the wintertime months. Why is that? It's because of the need for irrigation. Most of the water that we provide during the summer is, in fact, used for irrigation purposes. And in order for us to maintain adequate water supply, we need to be able to work with our professional associates in the landscape industry to use the most efficient water delivery systems possible. Technology changes over time. It changes rapidly. And we want to ensure that the professionals in this line of work are up to speed on the most efficient ways to deliver water to the intended purpose. There was one comment made that was a little bit disturbing, and I want to be very clear with this committee. Having these contractors be up to speed and certified in backflow technology is critical. When a landscaper uses compressed air to blow out an irrigation system, If that were to get into the community supply of water, it could have disastrous effects. This is absolutely a consumer protection, public self and health and safety issue that must be maintained. And with that, we oppose Senate Bill 474. We believe that the changes and modifications that were made in Senate Bill 580 were fair. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mark.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer and committee, I think that's how I'm supposed to say it. I appreciate your time. Several of us landscapers are in the room. As I think it's about 8% of the 0.8% of the entire licensed industry in Oregon of companies is in this room.
Sir, could I get you to put your name on the record, please?
I'm Ben Cunningham. Sorry, with Eden's Image Landscape. There are a few issues I think that have been brought up. No one is opposed to continuing education. We're opposed to mandatory continuing education. Several of us are. I'm in favor of Senate Bill 474. Another item that I heard was a concern for public safety with water, water sources. There are several items, several tasks that landscapers can perform which do have some public safety ramifications. All of them require a permit or some form of oversight, inspection. Tying into water service is one of them. Building decks is another. So to do the process legally, even without mandatory continuing education, there are laws in place which would protect consumers, in essence, in theory, from shoddy work being done. Something that I heard also is that it is a, and I agree with, it is a difficult industry. Maybe restaurants are worse, I'm not sure. Several of my colleagues who have been in business for over 30 years can attest to seeing many landscape companies fail in that time. They are still in business because they have educated themselves. Before there was a law for continuing education, they stayed in business during that time. I haven't been in business that long. I haven't done much for over 30 years, but breathe. And I've been in business for about 8 years during the continuing education era. I don't advertise. I get business by word of mouth. Not all. I understand that that's not a model that all landscapers implement. I have. There's a lot of accountability in that for me. I serve people who know people that I have served. I don't get work if I don't do good work. That's how you stay in business. It's not by educating yourself necessarily. That doesn't hurt. It's a good tool, and any reasonable landscaper, I think, will continue to educate themselves, whether there's a law or not. It's by taking care of the customers that you serve. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there any questions? Okay, thank you. That's all I had signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment? Seeing none, we do not have the paperwork to deal to work session this bill today, so we'll close the public hearing, and I believe we have an informational hearing. We'll open an informational hearing on the Tribal Council.
Nancy D'Souza's here.
Her?
Nancy D'Souza's here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Nancy. And I'm going to give back to you. I'm going to go take care of some stuff. See you.
Yours. All right.
Center?
Oh, you're in trouble.
I'm in trouble.
Look what I got.
Vice Chair Thompson and members of the committee, my name's Nancy D'Souza. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Travel Experience, and we're getting our little slide presentation up on the screen. But while it happens, I can begin telling you a little bit about our agency. Thank you very much for inviting us here today to talk about our rest areas. A brief overview of the agency itself is we were created in the 1970s as part of the Highway Beautification Act. Oregon decided to do a highway logo sign program, and we took that over from ODOT at that point. point, and we now have the Oregon Heritage Tree and Historical Marker programs in addition to the rest areas that we'll be talking about in a few minutes. We are a semi-independent state agency, and we are governed by the Travel Information Council, which is composed of 9 members, 8 appointees of the governor. I have our chair and vice chair, Gwen Baldwin and Bob Russell, in the back of the room, providing moral support until they have to leave for a 4:30 commitment, at least. And one member is a member of the Oregon Transportation Commission. And as their executive director, I operate the agency along with my deputy, Tim Pickett, our operations director, under their guidance and administration. So it's a very good working relationship. So the history of how we got the rest areas, I think most of you know it, and it's in your materials. I've been asked to be brief, but essentially in 2008, Governor Kulongoski's Transportation and Tourism Task Force report stated that they believe that rest areas needed to be better funded, requiring an investment in uniform management. And so with that, the legislature chose to begin transferring some rest areas in 2009 with the Jobs and Transportation Act, and that started with 7 rest areas. And over the years, that number has increased to 29 rest areas in 17 locations around the state, mostly the I-5 and I-84 corridors. We also have one in Tillamook and one at Government Camp, of which Senator Thompson is well acquainted.
Oh, yes.
Our charge, long before I took this position 2 years ago, but it's one I wholeheartedly support, is to do things differently. The legislature requires us to maintain, manage, improve, and develop rest areas, and that's really important to providing safe, convenient, comfortable, and free rest stops for travelers in our state. In addition to restroom facilities, we're providing travel relief and relaxation, places for pets to exercise that are open and readily clean upable, cell phone internet use areas, and also wayfinding through our information kiosks and other information provision in the rest areas. We provide really valuable truck and automobile parking, particularly for the trucking industry when they need to be getting off of the freeway because they've reached their maximum hours. We provide a free, safe place for trucks to pull off for up to 12 hours. It's a venue for the free coffee program, support for travelers in need, and then again those information kiosks that provide important information for tourists and travelers to get to our communities. It's an important component of economic development to help people find their way into our communities and the services they provide. So the working model we have today is that we have a staff presence 8 hours a day, 365 days a year. That does make this model more expensive, but it ensures that our rest areas are clean, attractive, well-lit, and well-maintained. It gives us the opportunity to rapidly repair vandalism damage and address maintenance problems. It gives us a really knowledgeable interface with Oregon State Police and local law enforcement to help deal with any problems that might be arising from a public safety standpoint in these very open, heavily traveled public areas. Our on-call response time for after-hours emergencies is ideally an hour or less, and we have staff who live within a 45-minute driving range as a requirement of the job so that they can respond to those when they are on call. And we do a lot of responding to traveler inquiries and requests for assistance, whether it's we've installed lost and found boxes in all of our rest areas and return an incredible number of wallets and cell phones and car keys and occasionally a handgun to travelers. But it's an important service that we provide. We give jumps start to provide directions. It really is something our staff takes pride in. In doing so, we don't do it alone. We have partners in other state agencies and entities around the state, and our key partners are so important that we couldn't do our job properly without them. Obviously, ODOT, as the owners of the rest areas, is responsible for overseeing the requirements of proper use of the highway funds and regulating, making sure that as the owners of the property, we are maintaining them to the standards they expect, and they control the right-of-way of the highway system. Travel Oregon and Oregon's Destination Marketing Associations, we're really working closely with them, getting information. We're providing the infrastructure in our rest areas beyond the highway logo signs. Those kiosks and other things provide the means for tourism information to get into the hands of consumers. Oregon State Police is one of our best partners, and it's become more active over recent years. We've been able to develop a really close working relationship with our state police partners to enable us to have them be able to trust our staff when they say they're seeing a problem they trust that we're not crying wolf and they can come quickly if they're available. We have a truly useful exclusion program that started 2 years ago and now allows state police to be able, if they're seeing criminal activity or serious rule breaking, to tell people they can't come back to that particular rest area for between 30 days and a year. And that's proven very valuable to them, and they have expanded it statewide to all of our rest areas. So in taking over the system, we knew there would be day-to-day challenges. By design, our rest areas require a focus that isn't possible for ODOT with its broad scope. We're able to really put a laser focus on where the challenges are and evaluate and prioritize plans to improve both individual locations and the system as a whole. We work to address aging infrastructure, deferred maintenance, facility upgrades, and are constantly looking for ways to improve travelers' experiences. An example of taking something over is your rest area close by, Senator, at Government Camp. It was well used when we took it over. Now we have been able to upgrade the heating system, the parking lot, and facilities and amenities, in addition to the cosmetic improvements. And we now have clocked about, how many? 500,000 travelers a year coming in and out of that rest area, just into the restroom facilities themselves. And working with Clackamas County Tourism as part of that infrastructure and partnering with the community, Clackamas County has recently installed an electronic kiosk similar to the one that we have at French Prairie Northbound that is interactive and really does drive people to the tourism opportunities in that area and gas, food, lodging opportunities. So with over 18 million visitors a year to our rest areas statewide, we also get some unpleasant challenges. And you'll see up there some lovely pictures of vandalism and graffiti, drugs and paraphernalia. We've got a box of marijuana that was just kind of left. It was the leaves and stems and seeds, but still something that needed to be addressed and disposed of. There is there were several boxes of butane canisters that were left hidden in the bushes where somebody had been using it in an RV for methamphetamine production, and by calling state police before it had been contaminated, they were able to take that and potentially get evidence off of the cans that they might be able to use to identify the perpetrator. So those kinds of things, clogged sewer systems, it happens. We expect that. We do have toll-free numbers that are posted in each rest area for those response from our staff after hours and from state police. And this winter, we've had a lot of weather, and it continued today. And so you'll see a picture up there of Government Camp, but some of our other rest areas where we've had some incredible storm damage that we hadn't experienced in the 2 or 3 years prior. So being flexible and having our staff be responsive is a great reason to have those boots on the ground dedicated to that rest area. So then we also have unanticipated challenges, and that's one of the issues that's bringing us to this committee today for you to understand, is that we based the TIC model on a robust structure where we could anticipate everything we could, and then we've discovered over the years of experience there are some things that we weren't quite as prepared for as we would like, but we would like to be prepared for moving into the future. Certainly deferred maintenance. The age of the rest areas is such that many of the systems they rely upon, including water, sewer, and electricity, are aging and in need of upgrade and replacement. These systems are usually served by area water and sewer districts, and they expect us to maintain them to their standards. That costs money. Large-scale maintenance. Rest areas provide critical parking for cars, trucks. That has to be maintained. Paving constitutes a significant investment and must be done on a regular basis to prevent the deterioration of the substructure that, if left to fail, would be even more expensive to repair and expensive, but especially important for truck parking. ADA upgrades. Recently, ODOT was sued by Disability Rights Oregon. The settlement of that affected all ODOT properties, including the rest areas that we manage. There are costs to that. Tim is working on the financial side with our rest area administration of calculating how much that is, but it will be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these are the kinds of things that we couldn't really anticipate when we started the program. Another thing is that traffic counts are increasing. Oak Grove Rest Area on I-5 north of Eugene, the southbound one in particular, is terribly under capacity. As traveler counts continue to grow, it taxes that capacity. Traveler demand exceeding the capacity of a rest area, especially when it's football revelers who might have had a little bit to drink in the stands, and they get out of their buses or their cars, hopefully they're not driving, and they're seeing a line, often make alternative choices instead of waiting in line for the restrooms. It's not pretty. We have been working with our council to carefully evaluate what we could do out of some of the funds we've been able to reserve that I'll talk about to potentially replace that one side. But as you can see from, if you get to the next slide, we have more than 1.2 million visitors have visited that rest area, but you'll see, and it's included in your information online, is this map that shows all of our rest areas around the state in the most recent fiscal year's traveler counts, and they are increasing. If you'll go to the next slide, since we went up to 17 locations with 29 individual rest area buildings, it does continue to grow as traffic counts grow and people are using our rest areas more and more. That's a great thing. It helps with public safety, but something that does increase our costs. So how we've managed so far is that we've had to revise our original model. We get, for the operation of the rest areas now, $6.55 million a year transferred from the highway fund and ODOT to us. Out of that, and through careful management, our staff has been able to carve out some funds and set them aside for some of these capital maintenance and improvement projects. And where we are now, if you'll go to, that would be a replacement sign, wrong way. There we go. It is the funding is stable. We have a commitment from the Transportation Commission for that level of funding at $6.55 million through the end of this calendar year. And beyond that, if we are not part of some other funding mechanism provided by the legislature, it would go back to negotiations with the Transportation Commission of how many rest areas we would operate at what cost. But you will see that our costs do go up. We face the same cost drivers as traditional state agencies with personnel costs and PERS, but all of that capital maintenance and improvement and day-to-day operations, we face the inflation factors there as well. And so we do reach a point where the money that we have been able to carve out for capital improvement and maintenance, next one, we begin to spend it down. And so we do reach a point where we start going into the red and spend down our reserves. And so when we hit the 1921 biennium, we start running into some serious problems with the model the way it exists now. So a long-term solution is needed. We need stabilized funding, whether that's part of a transportation package or another bill, something that will help us deal with that inflation, and then having some resource for capital maintenance and construction funds to help us with that aging infrastructure. Like I said, Oak Grove, raising and rebuilding one side to current capacity, ADA standards, costs about $600,000. It's, I think, a really good deal for Oregon and important for the travelers in our state. But these cost money, and so that's what we are looking for on that realm. So basically, go to the last slide. This is one of my favorite quotes. It's a Yelp online review. But basically what it comes down to is what we favor is rest stops in a guaranteed bathroom without the obligation to make a purchase, easy off and back on the highway, taking much less time than trying to find somewhere in a city stop. We believe wholeheartedly in what we do. I am so proud of our staff. They take personal pride in the rest areas in which they work because they're members of that community. They help travelers. They are good liaisons, and they're often the first people that visitors coming to Oregon might interact with. And our model works, and I just encourage you to ask us any questions we can answer for you and ask for your support just of the program overall.
The rest stops are one of the things that really makes Oregon nice for tourists. I've traveled all around the country, and ours are among the nicest and cleanest anywhere in the country. And there's one thing in particular that I really like that you've done, and that'll say rest stop in 2 miles, next rest stop 32 miles. And so I turn to Mrs. Monroe and I say, you want to go here or you want to wait for another 32 miles? And it's kind of nice to know. And that works out great, except once in a while, it's the next one's in 32 miles and we get there, oh, this rest stop's closed. Not a good thing. Anyway,
yeah.
Appreciate your work.
Looks like we're going to have to do something funding. I am on the special funding committee, and we'll be looking at that.
Senator Monroe and Senator Thompson and Senator Monroe and committee. When a restaurant closes, it's usually for a good reason. We've got a sewer failure or one of these things with the aging infrastructure. So that's another one of the reasons that we are looking wherever possible to have that capital maintenance and improvement funding so that we can hopefully fix those things before it results in a failure.
Yeah. Nancy, could you do us a favor, just a couple of minutes or maybe
yes.
less or whatever, and explain when you say you are you're kind of a semi-agency, or what do you mean by that?
Vice Chair Thompson and members of the committee, a semi-independent state agency is one that's still fully a state agency in that our employees are state employees and we are executive branch members reporting and responsible to the governor and to the legislature. What it does, and different semi-independent agencies have different carve-outs from the statutes. Ours in particular gives us more flexibility in contracting and procurement. We still follow Department of Justice guidelines and their contracting responsibilities. It gives us more flexibility in our staffing levels, where a traditional state agency, if they needed more staff, would have to come to the legislature, go through the Ways and Means process after getting it approved by the governor's office. We can, within the approved budget of our council, go ahead and hire those staff as we need it, and our employees are at will. And so we don't have the same requirements, even though they do receive PERS and PEB and all of those other things. And so it's just a different level of flexibility. We are financially responsible to LFO and to the governor's office in that each year Tim and his staff hire through a Secretary of State-approved contractor a financial review that in particular looks at how we are spending our dollars, particularly those from the highway fund, and we've had clean audits every year that we haven't since they started.
Okay. Any more questions, committee? Great. Well, thanks for giving us that review.
Thank you very much.
You bet. You guys want to hang around another half an hour or so, or we're going to adjourn?
You can stay if you want.
No.
Ha ha ha.